From Michigan to Virginia, New Jersey to Arizona, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, cyber attacks are becoming more frequent and having a bigger impact on everyday American life. Michael Ellis of the Heritage Foundation is here for a closer look at the problem. The COVID-19 pandemic revealed the power exercised by state governors. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story on how they will be involved in the 2022 elections. It's called the PRO Act, and it is a frontal assault on worker rights. Eric Boehm from Reason Magazine gets details from Sean Higgins at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And it is important for conservative activists to get together to exchange ideas and network. On this week's American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA presents a model for a successful conservative conference. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. Cyber attacks have caused an East Coast gasoline shortage and disrupted the nation's food supply. Here to discuss the recent attacks and what policy steps need to be taken to address the problem is Michael Ellis. Michael is a visiting fellow for law and technology at the Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at the Heritage Foundation. Michael, welcome to American Radio Journal. Michael, in the last couple of months, there have been a number of very critical cyber breaches that have impacted the American public in ways that we haven't seen very often. They seem to be coming more frequently. Are we now hitting a point where these attacks are a critical weakness for our nation?
There certainly have been more attacks recently, but this isn't a new phenomenon. I think what is new is that these attacks are hitting companies that really impact Americans' everyday lives. The Colonial Pipeline ransomware attack, disrupting fuel supplies to nearly half of the East Coast, the disruption to the food supplies from the attack on JBS, a large meat processor. These ransomware attacks, we've seen them before over the last few years, and they certainly are scaling up in terms of frequency and the impact of the attacks. But the basic procedure of the attackers has remained unchanged. They take advantage of a vulnerability in the target's network. Once they're inside, they can move around laterally within the network, obtain the accesses that they need, and then when they're ready, they take over the target's network, encrypt their data, and demand payment, usually in Bitcoin or another form of cryptocurrency, in order to decrypt the network files and give the victim access back to their systems.
We have seen this, as you've pointed out, with a number of private companies. There also have been some notable government hacks, have there not?
That's right. And that's not a new phenomenon either, sadly. The government has known about the vulnerabilities of its computer networks to the hacks for several years. Think back to 2014 or 2015, the hack of the Office of Personnel Management and the background investigation files for millions of federal employees were exposed to Chinese hackers. And the federal government has been working on this issue to try to get better about defending its networks, but there's still a long way to go before we have fully addressed the problem. And part of the problem is that the attackers keep getting better and better. Frequently, with ransomware attacks, they're criminal enterprises, but the profit motivation is strong. And as companies' network defenses evolve, so too do the hackers seek to exploit new vulnerabilities, sometimes that the companies aren't even aware of yet. And in other instances where it's not a criminal gang, sometimes there are sophisticated nation-state military or intelligence services involved. If you look at the recent SolarWinds hack, I believe the U.S. government has attributed that to the Russian SVR, their intelligence service. It's simply unrealistic to expect a U.S. company to be able to stand up to the onslaught of a sophisticated nation-state adversary like that. They just don't have the capabilities, and this is an area where the government really does need to play a role in helping American companies, American critical infrastructure, defend itself from determined nation-state attacks. If Russian or Chinese missiles were hitting U.S. factories, we wouldn't expect the factory owners to build their own missile defense systems. We'd expect the government to step in and do something to stop the attacks, either by defending the companies or by taking military diplomatic action to stop the attacks from originating abroad.
As these attacks become more and more frequent, it does raise again the question, Michael, of the need for companies and or the government to disclose the attacks. This can get very complicated very quickly. Can you talk a bit about the need for some sort of centralized reporting for these type of breaches?
One of the problems that the government faces when confronting this issue is that we don't even have a full idea of the scope of the problem. Most companies don't disclose their breaches to the government or to the public. And there's some statistics to indicate that perhaps only one-third of all breaches are ever reported, because for most companies, this is an embarrassing development when this kind of hack occurs. They aren't eager to advertise bad news to their customers, to their shareholders potentially, if they're a publicly traded company. No one likes to be the bearer of bad news. And while these hacks are crimes and can be reported to law enforcement, there is no simple reporting mechanism into the federal government to the agency that has responsibility for defending critical infrastructure. That's the Department of Homeland Security. There's no process in place for companies to report the technical information that the government could use to help stop the attacks from affecting other potential victims. There's no centralized process in place that requires companies to give that information. In fact, if you look at the recent Colonial Pipeline ransomware attack, Colonial Pipeline reported the incident to the FBI quickly, but 5 days after the attack, this came out in testimony before the Senate, 5 days after the attack, the Department of Homeland Security, which has the responsibility for defending critical infrastructure, for defending other pipeline operators against similar attacks, 5 days later, they didn't have the technical information about what had happened. So if there were other pipelines that were vulnerable to the same kind of attack that the criminals used to shut down the Colonial Pipeline, DHS would have been helpless to assist the other pipeline operators in defending their networks. And that's a situation where we can do better. And in the paper that I recently wrote, I proposed that a single national requirement for reporting cyber incidents would simplify matters for companies. Right now, again, there's no single mechanism. Instead, we have a patchwork of different regulations for different sectors that can create regulatory confusion for the private sector.
Both Congress and the Biden administration, Michael, have started to take this situation, I think, a little more seriously, at least publicly, than what they had in the past. Any sort of policy proposals that are making their way through Congress or that the Biden administration has proposed to start dealing with what has obviously become a very critical threat?
Well, President Biden took some initial steps towards addressing this, and they're good steps. In an executive order that he issued a few weeks ago that requires federal contractors to report these kinds of hacks to the government, because obviously if the government is buying software from a company, it needs to know if that software has been compromised. Again, take a look at the SolarWinds incident, where it turned out that this software was used by dozens of government agencies and who were unaware that there was a vulnerability that had been exploited by Russian intelligence.
We have been talking with Michael Ellis. Michael is a visiting fellow for law and technology at the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, that, of course, at the Heritage Foundation. Michael, tell us just a little bit about the Heritage Foundation. You referenced a couple of articles that you have written. Where can folks find them on the web?
Thanks. The Heritage Foundation is a nonpartisan research institution dedicated to constitutional and conservative principles. And the articles that I referenced can be found online at www.heritage.org.
Michael Ellis of the Heritage Foundation. Michael, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
At the offices of the Club for Growth, we have Scott Parkinson standing by to bring us up to date on some political developments, and also we have some legislative activity queued up. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks, Loman. It's great to be back.
The Club for Growth, Scott, during its history, very rarely, if ever, has endorsed in state governor races, but things are shaping up a little bit differently this year. And let's talk first of all about the state of Arizona, where you took a rather extraordinary step.
The Club for Growth PAC used to engage in gubernatorial races very infrequently about 15 years ago. And since the coronavirus pandemic, we've been looking at the power of governors and states in response to shutting down economies and really impacting the daily life just as much, if not more, than Washington, D.C. And so we put together a proposal for our board of directors, and they unanimously approved the Club for Growth PAC beginning to reengage in these big state races for governor races.
Let's take a look at your first couple of endorsements. The first one, I think, being no surprise, it is Governor Ron DeSantis in Florida, who, Scott, has emerged somewhat of a rock star, a conservative rock star, as a result of his very deft handling of the COVID pandemic. Tell us a bit about the race in Florida.
Yeah, well, full disclosure, some of the listeners know I used to be Ron DeSantis' chief of staff in Washington, D.C., and worked with him on his transition when he became governor. We think that, obviously, he is the best governor in the United States right now. He has championed keeping Florida open, and Florida has really become this model for the rest of the country and other governors to try to mimic in terms of maintaining public health and also maintaining economic security for its citizens. And so Ron DeSantis was somebody that the Club for Growth PAC supported when he ran for the House of Representatives way back in 2012, and we're really excited to be supporting his reelection campaign for governor of Florida. Obviously should not have any credible primary challengers, but the Democrats, on the other hand, are bringing back that political chameleon, former Republican, former independent, current Democrat, Charlie Crist, is considered one of the two front runners for the Democratic nomination. And he's running against the only current statewide elected official for the Democrats, the Florida Agricultural Commissioner, Nikki Fried.
Florida, of course, a major state, so we will keep an eye on the race, the reelection race for Ron DeSantis. Meanwhile, let's go all the way across the country to the state of Arizona. Interesting developments there. Arizona, of course, Scott, one of those sort of purple states that's in play a lot. So what's happening there?
Yeah, you know, Arizona used to be pretty bright red, and you've had some shifting demographics. I think races have gotten close. They've always sort of embraced this maverick personality. That's, on one hand, what John McCain was, and then maybe for the left, that's what Kyrsten Sinema appears to be at times. And so there's a former U.S. Representative, Matt Salmon, who initially served in the House of Representatives from 1995 to 2001, and then he ran for governor against Janet Napolitano, lost a really, really close race by less than 1% way back in 2002. And so Salmon, back in 2012, decided to come back to Congress, and he served two more terms, but again announced his retirement following the end of the 2016 cycle, and so he came out in January 2017. He is the current Vice President of Government Affairs at Arizona State University, and has a really, really solid record with the Club for Growth Foundation annual scorecard. Combining all of his record, he was a lifetime 92%, which in our view is really undoubtedly a conservative star. So we know that Matt Salmon will take the same approach that he had as a member of Congress in terms of trying to rein in out-of-control spending. He's going to be a champion for school choice and decreasing burdensome regulation on Arizonans, and fighting for those low taxes that we think also allow for economic productivity.
Pivoting now to Washington, D.C., Scott, the Democrats continue their efforts at ramming through a lot of legislation here, as they have a razor-thin margin in the Congress and the United States House of Representatives. They're tied out in the Senate. Senate 1, Senate Bill 1, is up for a potential vote this coming week. Please explain again for our listeners what S1 is, and doesn't look like they're going to be able to get it over the finish line.
S1 is also known as the For the People Act. I think that the Republicans in Congress have branded it the Corrupt Politicians Act. It would subsidize federal elections through taxpayer money, ensuring that more of your tax dollars are funding those negative campaign ads that nobody can stand. It also codifies really what happened in the 2020 election in terms of mail-in ballots and drop boxes and election access. But that created really this uncertainty whether or not elections had integrity. And Democrats want to move forward with the For the People Act, the Corrupt Politicians Act. because they want to try to codify the strength that they had in the 2020 elections to win. We think that elections should be fair. They should be managed by the states, and this is a big-time federal overreach. But the good news is Joe Manchin has said that he opposes that bill, so we don't expect it to pass the Senate. The bad news is that Joe Manchin has recently put out his own compromise legislation that includes a dozen or so provisions in relation to the way that elections are managed. And I think he's, you know, certainly feeling the heat from the radical left and their base. He wants to try to put forward a consensus agenda on elections that can get Republican support. And right now he's circulating that memo among another dozen Republicans to try to get them on board, and then hoping that he can get a bipartisan compromise rather than, you know, really a partisan effort, which is the Corrupt Politicians Act.
We have been talking with Scott Parkinson, who is with the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Sure thing. So the Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. If your listeners want to learn more, our website is clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, as always, thank you for being here.
All right. Thank you.
The proposed PRO Act is pro-union, but it is not pro-worker. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine finds out why from Sean Higgins at the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
Labor unions spent over $27 million to help get President Joe Biden into the White House. He's, of course, a self-described union man, and now the unions, well, they're looking for a return on that big investment. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is Sean Higgins. He is a research fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, a former reporter, former journalist as well at the Washington Examiner, and he joins us now to talk about a new report that he's published at CEI.org. You can find it there. It digs into the depths of something called the PRO Act. That's the Protecting the Right to Organize Act. It's one of the big priorities that Democrats have in Congress this year. He joins us on the phone to talk about it. Sean, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Happy to be here.
So let's start, I guess, just with an overview, because I think this is a thing, unlike some of Biden's big proposals, infrastructure spending, stuff like that, this is maybe something that not a lot of people have probably heard of, even though it's kind of part and parcel to the infrastructure plan in some ways. Just sort of walk us through it, if you can.
Yeah, the Protecting the Right to Organize Act primarily rewrites sections of the National Labor Relations Act, and it also does amends the Labor Management Reporting and Disclosure Act. Primarily what it does is it gives unions new powers to require workers to sort of fall in line and support them. One of the principal things it does is it just straight up eliminates all state right to work laws. They will be abolished. These exist in 27 states, and these are laws that say that if a worker doesn't want to join a union, he cannot be coerced into doing that as part of his job or required to financially support the union otherwise, which is what they typically do to sort of get around that. In 27 states, that's the right workers have. The PRO Act would simply strip that right away from them. It would essentially create a national version of California's AB 5 law to limit private contracting. And this is essentially an attempt to force the gig economy companies like Lyft and Uber to treat all their workers as employees. The problem with this law, and this is what happened in California, was that anytime you try and write the law to do this, you basically ensnare all the sort of people who are in traditional freelance occupations and create this system where nobody can work for anybody unless they're really directly an employee. And that means that the employer has to dictate their schedule, their work hours, all the type of stuff. It basically eliminates the ability of freelance. It would severely curtail the ability of freelance workers to make a living. It would make unions automatic winners in disputed elections before the National Labor Relations Board. Essentially, if the board found some irregularity or something like that, the tie would go to the union. It gives workers no say in the protection of their private contact information. If a union wants to organize a worksite, this would require the employers to give them direct access to the workers' private emails and phone numbers and such, which is bizarre in a social media age. I mean, if workers actually wanted to join a union, they could just go online, or if they're just curious, go online and, you know, check out a social media site or a Facebook page or whatever and learn all they need to know about what the union is and its intentions and goals are. Why people who don't want to do this have to nevertheless have the prospect of people knocking on their door and trying to tell them why they should belong to a union.
Yeah, it seems like so much of this is geared towards exactly that, right? Like only 6% of the population, 7% of the population, the workforce, I should say, not even the population, are part of a union right now. It's not as if workers really were clamoring to join unions the way the president apparently thinks they are, then you wouldn't even need these sorts of things. You mentioned at the end there about the elections, and I think that's kind of important and the NLRB's role here, because there's a situation that could play out here where you might have a workplace that votes to unionize or not. The no side wins, but then the NLRB comes in and says, oh no, actually yes won. Is that right? Is that something that could happen here?
That theoretically could happen, yes. If the union alleges that the employer interfered in the voting, essentially the burden of proof would be on the employer to prove that it didn't do this. And in any case where it's just sort of ambiguous, the NLRB could simply declare the union to be the winner, and that would simply be it. Now, obviously, this does sort of involve the career bureaucrats on the NLRB, and these are by and large people who are serious about their job, but they all do also tend to lean towards the pro-union side, because people who get involved in this type of work are the people who are more inclined to support unions.
Yeah, and whether they lean to the pro-union side or not, I mean, it's still just like it's the federal government coming in and weighing in on a decision that is a decision that's being made within one workplace. That's kind of what bugs me about that. We're talking with Sean Higgins. He is a researcher at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. He's got a new report up there, Workers to Lose Freedoms and Protections If the Union PRO Act Passes. Sean, just about a minute or so left here, but I mean, this is a point you make in your piece, is that this is proponents of the PRO Act talk about this as being empowering workers. Really, though, this is about the union bosses.
Yes. The issue here is people like Richard Trumka, the president of the AFL-CIO, are fond of claiming that there's millions upon millions. In fact, he's put the number at like 60 million people would actually want to join unions if they could. But the reality is that if that were the case, then things like abolishing right-to-work laws wouldn't be necessary for unions to advance, because nothing about a right-to-work law prevents a worker from joining a union if that's what they actually want to do. All it does is it makes it their own choice. So if they were all clamoring to join unions, right-to-work laws would be irrelevant and wouldn't need to do anything. The fact that they want to get rid of them is sort of the proof in the pudding that, to a large extent, they just want to get these sort of stubborn people to fall in line.
Yeah, the unions want everybody to have the choice to join a union as long as they make the right choice. That seems to be the case here, and the PRO Act will tip that scale towards the union bosses, who, of course, their paychecks come from the fact that they get paid by all their members, and so that's why they're interested here, obviously. We are out of time for today, but check out Sean's report again. That's at CEI.org. Sean Higgins, research fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And you can check out more of our coverage of the PRO Act, everything else that's happening in Congress and the Biden administration as well at Reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
Pennsylvania recently held a successful conservative conference. On this American Radio Journal commentary, Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA explains how your state can have one too.
With over 200 subscribing radio stations in 45 states, American Radio Journal is truly a national program, and we try to address issues of national importance. But today, I want to focus our attention on one event in one state that should become a model for gatherings of conservative political activists in every state. It's called the Pennsylvania Leadership Conference, and it's a two-day affair run by the creator of American Radio Journal, Loman Henry. The rescheduled annual event was held last weekend outside Harrisburg, the Pennsylvania state capital. The attendance was over 700, most of them ordinary citizens moved to become political activists by their concern for the future of their state and nation. Grover Norquist, head of Americans for Tax Reform and one of the most experienced and successful of national conservative leaders, has repeatedly cited the Pennsylvania Leadership Conference as the best single state-focused conservative gathering in the country. If you are a concerned citizen in another state, I encourage you to familiarize yourself with the Pennsylvania model so that you can enjoy a similarly successful event in your own state. The first place to go to learn more about the Pennsylvania Leadership Conference is the event website, paleadershipconference.org. The basic idea leverages the self-interest of politicians, organization heads, and corporate sponsors, and the effect of all three segments achieving their goals makes it effective and sustainable from year to year. There's nothing unique to Pennsylvania in that structure, so it can be duplicated easily elsewhere. Let's take a look at each element. The affinity of politicians for a microphone and a stage, particularly in front of a friendly audience, is universal. Inviting officeholders and office seekers with viable conservative platforms is close to a no-brainer, except that some effort should be applied to be sure that a full issue spectrum is covered. Pro-life, pro-Second Amendment, pro-law, pro-low taxes, pro-business, pro-military, pro-religious freedom, for example. Those are seven distinct issues, and it should be easy to identify officeholders and office seekers who can speak to them. It helps to pre-screen them carefully to avoid hosting impossibly long shots or intemperate demagogues. Every state has one or more chambers of commerce or business and industry, and they always have a legislative agenda, so identifying and inviting one of their spokespeople should be a snap. The NRA has a state chapter, and if their spokesperson is a good one, and there's almost always a current state-level issue involving responsible gun rights, so that one should be easy too. As wokeism continues to spread and to threaten our schools and colleges, identifying the best speaker in favor of truth-based education will almost assuredly produce a lively session. National organizations such as the Family Research Council and the Heritage Foundation have speakers bureaus with knowledgeable experts on many fields, and in most cases they are available without speakers' fees. In your own state, there are probably chapters of national grassroots conservative organizations like the Faith and Freedom Coalition or Americans for Prosperity who will jump at the opportunity to speak in front of a room full of patriots. Assembling an agenda with most or all of these groups in your state is not an easy task, but it is certainly a manageable one. But that's not the full recipe for success. There needs to be a little icing on the cake, in the form of a well-known speaker with a national following. Speakers' bureaus exist to help you find these speakers, often at fees in the range of $25,000 to $50,000. But for a first-time event, don't forget that members of Congress or the U.S. Senate cannot accept speaking fees. If your state is seen as a swing state or especially significant in national elections, you should look at potential presidential or vice presidential candidates. There are plenty of them to go around these days, so choose wisely, and you'll find you have a headliner who will put your event in the news, possibly at the national level. There's nothing better than positive free publicity generated by positive free speakers. So use the Pennsylvania Leadership Conference as a kind of template for your own leadership conference in your state. Start with a one-day event on a Saturday, and after a couple of years, grow it into a two-day affair, probably by adding a Friday. And as your event takes off, so will your impact on your state's political and policy agenda. With a little imagination and a lot of planning, you can do what every true patriot yearns for, to make a difference in your state. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including KZOY AM and FM in Sioux Falls, North Dakota, along with KEDU FM in Rodoso, New Mexico. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.